This episode is brought to you by Charles Schwab. Decisions made in Washington can affect your portfolio every day. Washington Wise from Charles Schwab is an original podcast that unpacks the stories making news there. Listen at schwab.com/washingtonwise.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
The Senate is scheduled to vote this week to override Donald Trump's declaration of an emergency, national emergency, at the southern border. We'll tell you why Senate Republicans are frustrated with the president and how they're trying to avoid a vote. Plus, 50 people, including many rich and famous, are indicted for fraud to get their children into elite colleges. What this tells us about American higher education. And are there any political implications? Welcome. I'm Paul Gigot here with my colleagues, Kate Batchelder. How are you, Kate?
I'm good, Paul.
And Kyle Peterson. Hello, Kyle.
Hello, hello.
So let's start with the Senate national emergency, border emergency vote. There will be a vote in the Senate. The House already voted to override the president's emergency declaration, which he is using to allocate several billion dollars from the military construction budget to apply to the border. The House overrode it, as I said, and now the Senate is coming up for vote. Already four Republican senators have declared that they will vote to override, which means the president would have to exercise his veto. The drama, such as there is here, is that as many as 10 or 15 other Senate Republicans, and I've talked to several of them, are poised to maybe join those four, which would be a quite embarrassing vote for the president. They're working behind the scenes to try to see if the president will end that emergency declaration.
Right. I mean, it's still a pretty fluid situation here, Paul, on what we can expect to happen, because I think Senate Republicans really would like to avoid, one, taking up a resolution that is a House Democratic resolution and giving the House Democrats a real victory in dividing Republicans in the Senate and turning them on the president and all that goes with that. So there are a number of ways in the mix on how that might be avoided. Republicans have been talking for weeks about amending the resolution in some fashion, but it doesn't look like that's going to work because of Senate procedural hurdles. They also have talked about Mike Lee now has a bill out that would basically amend the National Emergencies Act, which I think many Republicans think gives the president too much discretion to declare emergencies for kind of indefinite periods of time. So the Mike Lee bill would basically allow a president to declare an emergency, but if after 30 days, Congress would have to vote to continue it. Now, the thinking here is maybe if they vote on this in addition to the declaration, some Republicans will ignore it, will vote with the president on the emergency declaration, and then still get to voice some concerns by voting for these changes to the National Emergencies Act.
The biggest action, though, is behind the scenes where several senators are trying to persuade the president to not use the military construction money, but cobble together $5.7 billion from other funds, including a Pentagon fund that is supposed to – that goes to drug interdiction, and use that to fund the border wall and border security, and that would not require an emergencies declaration, and then they would essentially have no need to take the vote. And the reason they want to do that is because they don't want to take the vote, because they figure it's a lose-lose proposition, right? Because no matter what you do, Kyle, you end up angering somebody. If you vote against the president, you anger Republicans who support Trump. If you vote not to override him, then you anger swing voters in states where there are a lot of swing voters, like Colorado, where Cory Gardner is running for re-election, Martha McSally running in Arizona, and other places.
Right. But the problem with that theory is that it requires Donald Trump to back down. And everything that I know about this president suggests that that's unlikely. I mean, he stood in the White House Rose Garden and talked for 50 minutes about this problem and said, I'm going to declare a national emergency. We're going to get this fixed. We're going to build this wall. And I just don't see him stepping back from that line, even though it has become very clear that he has kind of backed himself into a corner. I mean, looking at some of the poll numbers, a poll from Morning Consult out today. 80% of Republicans support the emergency declaration. 80% of Democrats oppose it. Okay, that's expected. So what about independents? Independents oppose it 2-1. 57% think it's a bad idea. Only 30% think it's a good idea. So this is like the reverse of a wedge issue. I mean, he's staked out some ground where his base really supports him. The other side opposes him. And the middle ground is all generally people who oppose him.
In the last three or four days, Kate, I've talked to two Republican senators, one more moderate, one conservative, who both said this is the most needless self-inflicted wound in their memory, because the president, they say, could declare victory on the border by saying, I've cobbled together these $5.7 billion worth. I can build as much wall as we can possibly build this next fiscal year with that money. So why endure a defeat politically that makes life more difficult for the reelection prospects of Republicans, senators in 2020?
Right. I mean, unfortunately, I don't think Donald Trump is persuaded by the election prospects of his own party, which is too bad. But I think that what you're describing is we're seeing a doubling down, because the $3.6 billion in military construction will not be able to be spent by October 1 when a new round of appropriations negotiations begin. So he has this $5.7 or so billion at his disposal through statutory authorities that he can use for instance, there's a Treasury Department forfeiture fund that can be used for general law enforcement purposes. So he could use that to get started on building the border. But another reason that I think he should be really concerned that this issue doesn't go away is the fact that the National Emergencies Act allows for votes in Congress every 6 months as long as the emergency continues. So we know he won't be able to spend the military construction money before October 1. So that suggests that the national emergency will go on longer. And then House Democrats will initiate this process again as soon as they can for another embarrassing, pointless fight even closer to an election.
Well, and then every 6 months thereafter, I mean, right up through the election, they will try to do this. Putting Susan Collins of Maine, for example, looks to be running for reelection. Tom Tillis of North Carolina, who is running for reelection. Cory Gardner in Colorado, and Martha McSally and others are right on the spot. It makes it a very difficult vote. And again, I don't know what – I mean, Donald Trump is discovering what life is like without a Democratic House. I mean, without a Republican House, with a Democratic House. Imagine what his life would be like if he has a Democratic Senate and if he's reelected.
Right. And the trouble with the Mike Lee bill, the problem there is that once Congress extends its power, gives it to the executive, gives it to the president, it's very difficult to take it back. You see the same dynamic happening on tariffs. Under Section 232, Congress has given the president unilateral power to impose certain tariffs. And now there's a lot of Democrats and a lot of Republicans even who think that maybe they've gone too far. They want to take some of that power back. But the trouble there is that you are trying to get power back from a president who has a veto authority. So the guy who's using the authority you granted, you're trying to winnow that authority, but you have to get over his veto in order to do that.
We're talking about the national emergencies override vote in the Senate and the college admissions scandal, Operation Varsity Blues. You're listening to Potomac Watch from the Wall Street Journal.
The Capital Ideas podcast now has a new monthly edition hosted by Capital Group CEO Mike Gitlin. Investment professionals reveal their best mentors, how they find their next great idea, and a few funny stories. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. American Funds Distributors, Inc.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Welcome back. I'm Paul Gigot, and we're talking about the National Emergencies Declaration with Kim Strassel and, I mean, excuse me, with Kate Batchelder. Pardon me, Kate. And
it's
pardon me, Kyle, and Kyle Peterson. And so, Kate, just give us your quick insight. And what do you think if there is a vote? What happens?
Well, I think there will be a straight up or down vote, because I think to avoid that, the president would have to agree to back off the emergency or to some other kind of deal that doesn't seem to be in the offing before a vote as early as the end of this week. So I think you see it passing with pretty broad support. I mean, I think 10 to 15 Republicans, I think 15 is a little high, maybe closer to 10, vote for it, and then the president vetoes it. And so nothing becomes law, and then we'll see you in 6 months, and we'll do this exercise all over.
Well, and meanwhile, the people affected by it, if they can get a hearing in court, get standing, they'll sue, and the money could be blocked anyway.
Right.
Right. And remember, too, that 6 months from now, we'll have a list of military construction projects that have been delayed as a result of this decision by the president. That'll be much worse.
All right. Let's move on to the college admissions scandal. 50 Americans indicted, including a couple of actresses, famous actresses Felicity Huffman, Lori Loughlin, and some very prominent people in law and business indicted for fraud, for working through alleged fraudster named William Rick Singer, who basically tried to get SAT scores changed, ACT scores changed, bribed allegedly admissions officials and sports officials at different universities to get get children into college. The prosecution effort is called Operation Varsity Blues. There may be more people who are indicted. This is really a remarkable story, and I think is one of those things that, because everybody cares so deeply about their children and wants their children to succeed, and college and entry in college is such a touchstone for half of the population that wants to send their children to college, that this story is going to have some legs.
Yeah, I agree with that. To my eye, one of the things that it exposes is how much colleges have gotten into the business of prestige and credentialism rather than education. So some of the allegations here are that parents' kids claimed that they had a disability, so they got more time on the tests, the ACT, the SAT. There were instances allegedly where the proctor of the test had been bribed to correct answers on it. This guy essentially said, I can get your kid whatever test score he or she needs. And what's interesting about that to me is that if admissions and curricula at these top schools are as rigorous as we are led to believe, then a kid who gets in with fake test scores, you would think, would not really do that well at Yale or Stanford or some of these universities. So this kind of fraud really should be self-limiting, but it apparently is not. So if a big chunk of the people who are applying to these universities and not getting in would do fine at them, then what are colleges selecting for?
Kate, the colleges here are Yale explicitly, and some of the others, I assume, if I haven't seen them quoted, officials quoted, but I assume they're taking a similar posture. They're saying, well, we're the victims here because these people conned us. And a couple of them have had to fire people in their athletic or admissions offices who allegedly took bribes. But are they victims?
I say not so fast to that. One reason is because we see that some of the payments here that were made not to coaches personally, though some of them were to coaches personally. But a lot of them went to the college sports program, like a $500,000 donation to Stanford's sailing program. And that should have attracted a more scrutiny from the colleges, I think. And also, you know, sports coaches, of course, have some leeway to recruit talented players, but was no one administratively overseeing this process? It seems like very suspect that the admissions office would have no quality control or no oversight on any of this process, and that so many sports coaches were willing to take these bribes. I mean, it doesn't sound like this alleged fraudster had any trouble finding clients.
No, it sure doesn't. It's fascinating. I mean, to your point about raising a red flag, two of the daughters, I think it is Lori Loughlin, the actress, to get into USC, they were portrayed as candidates to be coxswain on the women's rowing team. Now, this has led to much mockery in the press because in their YouTube video accounts and their social media accounts, these let's just say that their poses and the photos they posted were not of their athletic prowess. they were of their fashion accessories and their other exploits, but not of being athletes.
And this is the problem with what is defended as holistic admissions. So just to relate this to a different case, Harvard, of course, people know, has been sued for allegedly discriminating against Asian applicants who have very high test scores, and Harvard wants to balance its student body, it says. So it has defended what it calls holistic admissions. But what that means is that it's entirely a black box. Thousands of kids, send their hopes and dreams in a manila envelope to these schools. And they have no idea really on what merit or not they are accepted or rejected.
And the categories include things like in that black box, legacy. Did your parents, your grandparents go there? Donations? Did your parents give a big? Did they buy a building to build a school building? Race, gender, athletic prowess, sexual identity. Now, whether or not you spent your summer in Central America helping the poor, that kind of social justice credential is now very popular on in admissions for college seniors. So that opacity, I think, in this process does tend to create an opportunity for somebody like this to come in and say, well, I can get you like Singer and I can get you in because I know which levers to pull. In this case, it's pay money.
Right. And I think it's interesting, Paul, that it used to take several million dollars and a lifetime of legacy donations for these legacy candidates to get into these schools. But what we see now is kind of a more subtle way in which these admissions seem to be for sale. And what I mean by that is now, like you mentioned, it's expensive to go on these trips to Central America and build houses for the summer or to get the best SAT prep, a one-on-one tutor, because it is a test that you can learn in some ways, to get be the best violin player or a variety of other things that take a lot of investment from the parents and really do give you the perception that you can buy your way into these colleges without committing any crimes. But one of the most interesting things about this story to me is what it says about the parents, which is that many of the kids seem not to have known that their parents paid this guy to help them get the test doctored and whatnot. I mean, that really says that this is more about status perception for the parents than it is about the kids, their future success, or even wanting a better life for them.
Well, I mean, $500,000 for USC, that I don't know. I mean,
overpaid.
Yeah, I think that's overpaying for the prestige of USC. How is this going? I think one thing to watch is how this plays out politically, if it does, because with all the celebrities involved and the rich and famous, I think this is going to be reported for quite some time, and it's not going to go away, and particularly if we get more indictments, as Justice suggested, could be possible. So right now you see that the political left is making this is saying, well, using this to say this is another example of elites and the wealthy and people with connections who rig the system, and it kind of becomes another element in the attack on elites and the rich. Now, the populist right, on the other hand, which has been suspicious of academic institutions because of their left-wing political bent, may make this an attack on liberal politics of the academy and on its admissions process that keeps out a lot of average people.
Right. I think this plays right into Donald Trump's narrative of the swamp of, heartland America versus the coast. The uptake from this or the upshot from this is basically that there are a lot of people who would do fine at these institutions who can't get into them because, all the old legacy stuff, but also because people are going in through this side door, which is what this admissions fixer described as his route. And so what people may take away from this scandal is that, my kids would do fine at Harvard. They're just kind of locked out of the country club.
Kate, do you see any political implications here of this kind? Because I know that there have been, some conservatives have been saying that if Republicans have a political opportunity in going after the elite academy, not only on free speech grounds, but also on this elitist condescension grounds. And then the fact that they're now so expensive and putting so many people making students take big student loans, and they don't deserve the credentialing reputation that they have gotten, and we need to focus more on technical education, vocational education, and the students who don't have the wherewithal to go to these elite schools.
Sure. I think this really invites a strange left-right crossfire, as you mentioned, that might lead to some bad ideas that would be basically meddling in these colleges' affairs, which I would not support, though colleges have made themselves especially vulnerable to it by relying on student loans as essentially a business model that props them up financially. So I think you can see how you get there, though I do think that would be not an ideal solution. I think where Republicans have a strong case is that maybe these colleges, maybe we should open it up to more competition and try to change the societal stigma around not going to four-year college or even enlisting in the military or other options that are good for some students, and that college isn't the only path to success. I think that there's a huge appetite for that among parents who sort of suspect that the whole thing is a racket.
I agree with that, and it's the trouble is that it's sort of a social and cultural phenomenon, and it's not clear how to unwind that. I mean, college has become the one way that is perceived that you can get ahead in American life, and it's not clear how to build up other options. I mean, just to take journalism as an example, in the 30s, 40s, 50s, journalism was kind of a trade school job. People learned at work, or they learned, at some technical writing or something like that. These days, a lot of people at elite media institutions have degrees, journalism degrees, master's degrees, PhDs, Columbia University Journalism School. And it's not clear how you unwind that once the credentials have started to float upward.
Spoken as a journalism graduate of Iowa State University, I should say, Kyle, esteemed graduate, famous graduate now. But I agree with you. It's very tough. I mean, if you're sitting there with a college sophomore and you want to do the best thing for your child, and you say, and he comes, or he or she comes to you and says, Dad, I really don't think I'm going to go to college. The reaction of almost every parent I know is, what?
Or if you're sitting there as the hiring manager with a bunch of resumes in front of you, it's easy to see how, two candidates who may be equally smart, maybe equally talented, one of them has a shiny degree and one of them doesn't. It's easy to see how you can make that decision.
Yeah, but I just think some of these episodes are just becoming so revealing that we could possibly be heading for some kind of course correction.
When you say course correction, you mean that a kind of cultural change where college doesn't take on the role of college as a credentialing institution, credentialing degree, and the role of and the prestige of these universities is knocked down to size.
Is limited. I think that's already happening among hiring managers who don't look at top-tier universities the way they used to. I mean, that's me explaining my second-rate non-Ivy League education. I'm kidding. We don't begrudge you your Ivy League degree, Paul.
But thank you.
But I do think you could start to see just some change in those social norms as we continue to learn more about these admissions processes and continue to see more fallout from that.
It really is interesting. I mean, and politically, it's hard to know exactly how this plays out. But I do think this could be these indictments could be a big cultural moment. And the tragedy, I guess, in some sense, is that the merit based opportunity that a lot of colleges provided for upward mobility, certainly for two or three decades there after World War II, when colleges did open up to more merit, could be under threat. And that would be a tragedy, because colleges have been a source of upward mobility for a lot of people in the middle class. And I guess I'm a good example.
Yeah, and the people I think to feel the worst for in this whole scenario are the kids. I mean, reportedly most of them didn't know that their parents were meddling in their admission stuff. Some of them, I'm sure, could have went to UC Santa Barbara or, you know, a state school and just done perfectly well and gone about happy, productive, successful lives. And now they're going to be tarred with this, forever.
Thank you, Kate. Thank you, Kyle. And thank you all for listening. We'll be back later in the week with another edition of Potomac Watch.
This episode is brought to you by Vanta. Vanta's trust management platform helps you quickly assess risk, streamline security reviews, and automate compliance for SOC 2, ISO 27001, and more. Learn how by watching Vanta's on-demand demo at vanta.com/WSJ.